All right, so have you ever wondered what goes into building those tech systems that really work? Not just slapping code together, but making something that can grow, handle problems, and, well, actually solve real
It's
problems.
not magic.
Definitely not magic. We're taking a deep dive today into the world of solution architects. They're like the masterminds behind all these systems, the ones making sure everything runs smoothly.
Yeah, they're the ones thinking about the big picture, how everything fits together.
And we've got experts here who have seen it all. We're talking complex systems, cutting-edge technology, even those old legacy systems that, well, we all have to deal with sometime.
Oh, absolutely. Those legacy systems can be a real challenge.
But let's start with the basics. What exactly does a solution architect do? I mean, they're not just coding all day, are they?
Not exactly. You see, it's more about understanding the why behind the what. They have to grasp the business goals, what the users need, and any technical limitations.
So it's like being a detective almost, gathering all the clues before you can even start building the case.
Precisely. And speaking of building, solution architects are the ones making sure the foundation is strong, that the system can grow, and that it can handle, well, pretty much anything you throw at it.
So they're like the architects of a building, making sure the foundation is strong and can handle future expansions.
That's a great analogy. They need to see the whole structure, not just individual bricks. And just like an architect needs to understand different materials, a solution architect needs to know the strengths and weaknesses of different technologies.
Makes sense. Now, imagine building a massive e-commerce platform. It's a huge project. Where do you even begin?
One of our experts, Emily Carter, she starts by really understanding the business needs. Then she breaks the system down into its core parts, storage, networking, all that.
I've heard these architects love visuals. It seems like a good way to explain these complex systems. What kind of visuals does she use?
Oh, she loves using what's called the C4 model. It's basically a way to visualize the system at different levels. You can zoom in to specific parts or zoom out to see the overall picture.
So everyone involved, from the developers to like the business folks, can understand what's going on.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Sometimes what looks great on paper doesn't work so well in reality.
Oh, I bet. Does Emily have any stories about that?
Well, she shared one where they had this plan, looked perfect, but then during testing, they hit some major latency issues.
Oof, that's going to be frustrating. So what did they do?
They had to pivot, adjust the plan and tweak the architecture to handle the real-world load.
So being flexible is key.
Absolutely. You got to be ready to learn, iterate, and come up with solutions to those unexpected problems.
All right, so the system is built, everything's running smoothly, and then bam, user demand explodes overnight. What happens then?
That's where scalability comes in. We talked to Jason Lin. He's all about designing systems that can handle these massive spikes in demand.
And how do they do that? What's their secret weapon?
Microservices. Think of it like breaking the system into smaller, independent pieces that can each be scaled up or down as needed.
So it's kind of like a team of specialists, each handling a specific part of the job.
That's a great way to put it. And then there's monitoring. It's like having a dashboard that shows you how the system is performing in real time.
Okay, so you can spot any potential problems before they become like major disasters.
Exactly. Jason talked about a project where they used sharding and partitioning. It's all about dividing up the data and distributing it across multiple servers.
Those are some technical terms. Can you break that down a bit more? Like, what do those actually mean?
Sure. Imagine a giant library that's getting way too crowded. Sharding is like splitting that library into smaller branches. Partitioning is like organizing the books within each branch, by genre or author.
So it's all about dividing and conquering the data so everything runs smoothly.
You got it. Now let's talk about choosing the right tools. There's so much out there, from brand new tech to those reliable but maybe less exciting older tools.
How do you decide what to use? I mean, it's tempting to always go for the latest and greatest, right?
It's tempting, but not always the best choice. Diana Shaw, another expert we spoke to, says it's about understanding the specific needs of the project.
So, what does Diana look at when making these decisions? What are the key factors she considers?
Well, she considers things like the learning curve for the team, how stable the technology is, and the level of support available. Sometimes those tried and true tools are the best fit, especially when you need reliability and a strong support community.
It's not always about chasing the shiny new toy, right? Sometimes the reliable old tools are the best fit. But speaking of old, How do you deal with those legacy systems, you know, the ones that have been around forever?
No, legacy systems, they can be a real pain for solution architects. It's like trying to, fit a square peg into a round hole.
I bet. Especially when you're trying to integrate them with newer technologies. How do you even bridge that gap?
Well, Emily Carter had this interesting example from a healthcare project. They had this new cloud-based patient portal that needed to talk to an ancient system that held all the patient records.
Wow, that sounds like a nightmare. How'd they manage to connect those two?
They used something called a middleware layer. It's like a translator, you know, helping two systems that speak different languages understand each other.
That's clever. But what about budget constraints? How do you balance innovation with, well, the reality of limited funds?
It takes creativity, for sure.
Yeah.
Jason Lin, our cloud native expert, he's a big fan of proof of concept projects.
So basically, you build a small scale prototype to show what's possible without spending a ton of money.
Exactly. It's a low risk way to experiment and, you know, show the value of new technologies.
And what about using the cloud to keep costs down?
Jason's all about that. He loves cloud services that offer flexibility and scalability, things like auto scaling and pay-as-you-go pricing.
So you only pay for what you use and can easily adjust as your needs change. That makes sense. But what about the long-term costs, you know, the maintenance and upkeep of these systems?
Well, that's where automation comes in. Diane Shaw, our DevOps expert, she's big on automating those repetitive tasks.
I can see how that would save time and probably a lot of headaches. But what kind of tasks are we talking about automating here?
Things like building, testing, deploying software, you know, those tasks that can be time-consuming and, well, prone to human error.
So you're not just saving money, but also improving efficiency and reducing errors. Sounds like a win-win.
Exactly. It's a core principle of DevOps. Now, we've talked a lot about technical challenges and budgets, but what about the people involved?
Right. It's not just about the technology itself. It's about the people building and using these systems.
Exactly. Solution architects, they need to be great communicators. They work with developers, engineers, business stakeholders, everyone.
So they're kind of like diplomats, making sure everyone is on the same page.
That's a perfect way to put it. They need to explain complex stuff in a way that everyone understands.
Emily Carter mentioned regular check-ins with everyone involved. Why is that so important?
It keeps everyone in the loop. You can catch potential problems early on, address concerns, and, you know, make sure the project stays on track.
It's about building trust and making sure everyone feels heard.
Exactly. Open communication is key. And Jason Lin, he stressed transparency, especially when it comes to those tough decisions, like technical trade-offs.
Making sure everyone understands the why behind the decisions being made, that makes sense. But with all these complex systems, what about security? That's a big concern, right?
Huge. Security can't be an afterthought. It has to be part of the design from the very beginning.
So how do you approach security from an architectural perspective?
Emily's a big fan of defense in depth. Think of it like a castle with multiple layers of protection. If one layer fails, you've got backups.
So multiple layers of security measures, like what? Give me some examples.
Think firewalls, intrusion detection systems, access controls, encryption. Each layer adds another level of protection, making it way harder for attackers to get in.
It makes sense, but managing all those layers must be complicated.
It can be, which is why Emily also recommends using security tools and services that automate some of those tasks. Things like vulnerability scanning and threat intelligence.
So you're using technology to automate security and make the system even more robust. What about the people? They can be the weakest link sometimes, right?
Oh, absolutely. Diana Shaw, she really emphasized the importance of clear security policies and, you know, training everyone on best practices.
So it's about educating people about the risks and making sure everyone understands their role in keeping things secure.
You got it. Human error can lead to big problems. By raising awareness and providing training, you can really reduce that risk.
Wow, we've really gone deep into solution architecture today. It's not an easy job, that's for sure. You need to know the tech, you got to think strategically, and you have to be good with people. What's been the biggest takeaway for you?
You know, what really strikes me is just how adaptable these architects have to be. Mm-hmm. They're constantly dealing with new challenges like trying to integrate those old legacy systems we talked about, or handling those sudden spikes in traffic. And let's not forget about budget limitations.
It's a field where you can never stop learning.
Right, absolutely. It's like they're playing chess, always thinking a few moves ahead.
And like you said, they have to be able to explain those moves to others, even if they don't know much about chess.
Exactly. They're bridging that gap between the technical world and the business side, making sure everyone's on the same page.
It sounds like being a solution architect is more than just a job. It's a whole way of thinking, a problem-solving mindset.
You got it. And it's a career that's only going to become more important as technology keeps advancing.
Now, here's a question for you to think about. If you were building a complex system, what would be your biggest hurdle?
That's a tough one. Would you go for the latest, most cutting-edge technology? Or would you stick with something more reliable, even if it's not as flashy?
And how would you handle security? Would you rely on automated tools, or would you focus more on training people?
So many things to consider.
But ultimately, it's all about building systems that work, that solve real problems, and that make a difference.
It's about being a lifelong learner, always adapting and embracing new technologies.
So if you're up for the challenge, if you're fascinated by building those robust, scalable systems, maybe solution architecture is your calling.
Keep learning, keep experimenting, and never stop asking questions.
Great advice. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.